From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's have a little fun and open with some music.
Not just this music. We're not just... That's Rah Rah Riot. She's talking about somebody else.
Different music. Yeah. The kind you hear every day on NPR. BJ Lederman is the composer of many of NPR's theme songs. I'm sure you've heard the music of Morning Edition. And Weekend Edition.
Well, he's 61 years old now, and he just released his first ever pop album. It's called simply BJ, and he joined us to tell some stories, including a great story of how his late mother is featured on this album.
After Mom died, I realized that I had all of her voicemail messages still on my phone, and I dumped them into the computer, and then I handed them off to the wonderful producer, mixer man, Eric Serafin, who's a fabulous Los Angeles producer who had just moved to Asheville. And I couldn't face, you know, picking out which messages to use. So he picked them out, and the Randall Bramlett Band, by the way, who is the backup band on this album from
awesome
Athens,
yep.
Georgia.
Yep.
Yeah. They just set up a groove, and Eric just cut these things together, and it's a hoot. I mean, it's sort of wistful to me to hear her voice. You know, and I can do her voice pretty well. BJ, don't buy romaine lettuce. Now roll that thing.
BJ, don't buy or eat romaine lettuce. It's still E. coli. Regular lettuce is okay, but not romaine. This is your once a day loving mother calling you. Bye, darling.
So you do a very good BJ Lederman's mom. You're right.
BJ, how come my VCR is flashing 12 o'clock? Would you come over here and try to fix it?
That happens so often, Evan, that I came over there one day. I said, Mom, Congress has passed a law. It is now 12 o'clock all the time. So your VCR is right. Don't call me again.
You had all those messages, and this was actually really poignant for me because I'm in the process of spending some time interviewing my mom and dad and talking to my cousins, my brothers, about making sure we record conversations with those who are still around us.
That's a great thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. And we've already found so much value in it. I'm thinking of how you must have felt when your mom passes and you realize you have all these messages. And in a sense, there are these, you know, sort of just day-to-day, maybe banal things, you know, the romaine lettuce, the extermination in your place, but that's her, right? I mean, it's almost like it really keeps a sense of her alive.
Yeah, she was the most caring mom I could ever want to have. I mean, she was up my wazoo most of the time because I'm an only child. You know, the only children out there listening, you know what I mean. But I also have hundreds and hundreds of hours of videotape. I was a videotape kid ever since the first, you know, VCR camera came out. So I am digitizing all that stuff now. And what I realize is now I wish, you know, they should have this built into life. When your loved ones or your parents pass away, you get, you know, 5 to 10 minutes every year to ask them something, you know, because there's always something I want to know. Mm-hmm. But most of the stuff, I mean, like this, being on your show, having the album out, I mean, the first person I'd want to run to would be my mother, you know, after my dad passed away. Whatever.
Well, and for you, when you put that song together, was there any hesitation? Was there any sadness? Was that sort of poignant for you?
No, the only hesitation was, I know my mother would hate it being on the album. She had her private side, but I can hear my father saying, son, put it on. Put it on, it'll sell the album. You know, Dad was from vaudeville. He said, whatever type of, you know, promotional stuff you can use, go ahead and use it. And she would be like, Sammy, no, I don't want to be on the album. So I'm either getting my just desserts now, you know, with it out, or it's something she was proud of me, you know, ever since the first Morning Edition thing. They were both proud of me. So, you know, you want to please your parents, and then you got to learn how to please yourself.
Next up, what exactly is a panic attack? We hear the term, but for those of us who don't live with panic disorder, it's easy to misunderstand exactly how it can affect someone.
We welcomed Patrick Bailey, a peer advocate in the forensic unit of the Rochester Psychiatric Center. He described his symptoms and opened up about what helped him move his life in a more positive direction.
I have panic disorder, social anxiety, and a pretty extensive history with drugs and alcohol. So essentially, you know, the anxiety was there as far back as I could remember. I didn't have words to put on it. And at a young age, I started, you know, self-medicating with drugs and alcohol. And
what's young?
I started between 13 and 15. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that I was having mental health problems. I didn't really know what was going on. I know that I didn't like the way that I felt, and I was pretty afraid all the time. And so drugs and alcohol took that away for a long time, you know, here and there. And you know, but eventually, you know, it kind of stopped working and I hit rock bottom, you know, that same old story. And for the first time ever, I got honest about, you know, what was going on with my mental health and what was going on with my using and got the help that I needed.
Can I ask you, do you mind? I'm sorry to interrupt you, Patrick. I just want to make sure. I recall a conversation with a colleague a number of years back who talked about some, you know, I guess we'd call them panic attacks, that mm-hmm. kind of a thing. And for those of us who've never experienced it, his descriptions of it to me were not some of what we caricature. I mean, I think it's valuable to hear what it really is like. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. You know, for me, it usually involves a very high heart rate. My heart's beating out of my chest, actually sitting here waiting to speak. I could hear this thudding in my headphones because it's my heartbeat.
I have not made you comfortable. This is all, you can feel free to blame the host.
Well,
it's totally fine.
I think the universe has a sense of humor because I'm generally terrified in social situations or speaking, but I end up having to do it all the time, and it's the best form of therapy for me. You know, but essentially, it feels like the world's closing in on me in an impending sense of doom, shortness of breath, and sweating a lot. You know, I remember distinctly when I was trying to go into a community college, and I would try and sit in class, you know, try and be sober to be in class, and the anxiety and the panic attacks I was getting were so bad that I ended up just hiding in the hallway. You know, I didn't last very long. You know, I dropped out. I just couldn't function in life, you know, and that was the same story kind of happened with anything I attempted for most of my life.
What was the most important thing in your life that kind of steered you in a direction away from, again, substance using, kind of self-medicating in that way, and then kind of going down a better road?
I hate to sound cliche, but being sick and tired of being sick and tired. Mm-hmm. I could tell you crazy stories all day about, you know, the life that I led and things that I did. But I remember one distinct time that I had lost contact with my family, using worse than ever, kind of a recluse. And I saw my sister at a gas station, and she didn't know I was there. I was in a car that I was driving illegally, and I hid. I hid from her. I ducked down in the car because I was so full of fear, so full of guilt and shame for the life that I'd been living. And I hid from her, and she would have given anything to see me, to help me, to be there for me. And I just couldn't face her, you know. And, you know, when I look at, like, hitting bottom or getting a moment of clarity, it was around that time that I realized that I couldn't live like that anymore, you know.
How old were you?
I was 20 when I got sober and started to get honest and, you know, with the professionals I worked with. So that was about 5 years ago.
And what was step one, though? I mean, that's one thing to be hiding from your sister in a parking lot. It's another to actually leave that parking lot and then take a really concrete step. What was step one for you?
Leaving the situation I was in, for me, it looked like finding a new place to stay and going down to the DSS office and asking for assistance, getting help. I wound up in a shelter a few weeks later. And that's kind of where it started. And it really, the biggest theme was honesty, you know. There's a lot of great medication for anxiety. The ones that I was prescribed, I loved to abuse. And for the first time ever, I had to get honest with my doctor and tell him what I was doing and how it was affecting me and be honest with the drug and alcohol providers that were working with me. And that was the first step, like really getting honest, because I was so used to, if I'm talking to you about my mental health, or about my using, I'm lying, you know, because you're someone that can, a professional, someone that can get in the way of what I want to do, you know, or hinder the negative behaviors I'm trying to do. So I had to learn how to be honest about what was going on with me.
Let's turn now to Rochester Settlement Houses. They've been around since 1901, and these days they do some of the real grassroots anti-poverty work in the city.
We talked to Scott Benjamin, CEO of Charles Settlement House, and Rod Cox Cooper, CEO of the Community Place of Greater Rochester, and they talked about segregation and why our community remains so divided.
I am amazed at the disconnect sometimes between the haves and the have-nots, to be crass about it, really. I think it goes to race, class, and even geographically. You know, we're kind of blessed with an area that had lots of space. And as people decided, it's nice to own a car and live farther out and have a big yard and everything else. And we expanded water lines, sewer lines, and land was cheap. And so people with means started moving out and the companies went with them. And what happens is the people that weren't part of that expansion out have been left in neighborhoods without much economic development or, you know, enough to support the people living there. And as we see things with people moving back into the city, I hope that's going to change to some extent, especially with younger people moving back in, because I think that puts pressure on the education system to improve and it helps bring back some of the density. But I've made this point before. We sometimes curse the people that are living in poverty, trying to support an infrastructure that was built for 300,000 that now has 200,000, yet the area isn't really any larger. So it just means that fewer people are supporting an infrastructure that was built, you know, decades ago.
I think both of you in the work that you do in settlement houses and in the neighborhoods you work in get a chance to see how some of these issues play out on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis. I mean, Rod, why do you think we're so kind of self-segregated?
Differences. That's it. We are, and we need to be candid about it. I'll be the first to say, live where you want to live. I'm not saying people shouldn't live where they want to live, but we have to also understand this is not a growing region, and the more we spread out, the thinner the resources get in a particular concentrated area. This is not a growing region. We have the people that we're going to have here. We're about 1 million people in the greater multi-county area, and it's been the same for probably the last 3 or 4 census recordings. So this is not Charlotte, North Carolina, or Atlanta, Georgia. This is not some booming metropolis where we're getting all these new folks. The people that we have here are the people we're going to have here. So we might as well find ways to improve education systems, improve the services, transportation, to new opportunities and new jobs. When a company says they're coming into New York State or Monroe County and they're going to have 200 jobs, but it's in Clarkson or wherever it is, how does somebody from Portland Avenue, the area I serve, get there with this limited transportation? There are some ideas out there that are being looked at, van pooling, carpooling, all those kinds of things. Those are good, but we've got to commit to those. We've got to make those happen. It is also not a good sign when affordable housing options are only in certain areas. So if you live in the Northeast right now, but you're starting to see higher wages or what have you, you're moving so-called up, well, you go to the Southwest. I mean, you're still in the city of Rochester. You haven't really been able to break out into other areas because those other areas don't provide those opportunities. Affordable housing is frowned upon in a lot of suburban areas.
Whose fault is that?
I think it's the fault of, well, two levels. It's leaders who've held those positions and who run the other way when you talk about any regional solutions or regional approaches. We've seen how that's gone in our history. And that gets back to what I'm talking about, differences.
Finally, let's talk about your hometown. Do you love it? Do you hear a lot of people saying, there's nothing to do around here? Does that drive you crazy?
It drives me crazy. Does it drive you crazy?
It kind of does drive me crazy, yes. Actually, I hear that all the time. I'm always like, we're an hour from the Finger Lakes. Or shorter. I mean, what was the question? Who did I ask this week? Oh! No, it wasn't Chris. Oh, it was Lori Thomas.
Lori Thomas, candidate for mayor.
Yes. I asked her, where in Rochester is your favorite? You got a great afternoon.
You have a book. Where do you go?
She said Seneca Park, right?
Yes.
So anyway, Pontarun Bridge is one of my favorites, but there's lots of great places. Anyway.
There are. Anyway, that question drives Chris Clemens crazy. He is the creator of a website called Exploring Upstate, and he spent the last 3 years exploring the state, from the cities to the small towns to the hidden gems. And here's his take on hating on your own hometown.
I also think that that's changed a lot. I think when I was in high school a while ago, things were very different. And it was very common for people to say, like, there's nothing to do in Rochester. I can't wait to graduate and get out of here and go someplace else. And I think over the last decade or so, I've seen a big push from locals to have pride in not only Rochester, but I think the rest of the region. You're constantly seeing articles about Buffalo and how great places like Canal Side is and the food scene. And we're starting to see things online about people taking pride in their city or their town or even their region.
Why do you think so?
Well, I think part of it is social media. It's more accessible. Blogs, the internet, all of that information becomes more accessible, you know, in the early 90s.
God, that does feel like ancient history now, doesn't it?
It does. But we didn't have the ability to quickly bring up our phone and look on Instagram and see a
place. Dude, I was writing letters, like long handwritten letters as late as like 1998.
Exactly. So now imagine writing a letter to someone and say you should come to Rochester and see whatever.
They'll be like, you wrote a letter to me with a quill pen. Was it a quill pen? Yeah. So I think that's interesting because this opportunity to kind of really feel close and connected to people and learn what's going on quickly and see what's opening and what's happening. You know, in our upcoming Summer of Food series, we're going to be popping out to Leroy, out to Pulteneyville, and, you know, to places that are opening that I probably wouldn't have known about. You're right. 20 years ago, at least this far in advance.
Sure. So. Okay. Yeah, we now have Instagram accounts that are popping up before restaurants even start, and we're starting to learn about them. And I think as a result, those places become way more accessible. When someone puts up a blog post and shares a whole bunch of photos about a particular place, people realize this is actually a thing that I can go and I can experience myself, and I can establish a sense of myself and a relationship to it.
All right, so tell me real quickly, your favorite place in the city.
It's part of Turning Point Park, down by the Genesee River, near the beach, off the Stetson Street Bridge. What used to be the Stetson Street Bridge. If you're from Shalott, you know what I'm talking about, but now it's called the O'Rourke Bridge.
Great place. There's lots of great places around Rochester. You can make a map of it. And that is Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.